Okay, well, thank you for joining us today, Kevin Black, class VMI class of 99. We're taking a little bit of a departure from our normal setup. Normally, my colleagues, Emily Coleman and Derek Pinkham, host the show, but due to timing and schedules, it just turns out that the editor from behind the scenes is coming to the front of the screen, basically, and going to conduct today's podcast to interview. So we're going to jump right in and ask Kevin to share a little bit about his leadership journey, because that's what we want our audience to understand about listening to this show, is we're interviewing people because they have something to share that our listeners can get gain from in terms of their own personal development and leadership journey. So Kevin Black, give us a little history about who you are, what you do, and how you got into what you're doing.
Sure. So let me encapsulate who I am. In one sentence, I'm going to tell you who I am. Just give you a feeling of Kevin Black. I am a veteran army officer who one day read Ayn Rand and decided to do something productive with my life. So after 4 years of VMI, 6 years of active duty, I volunteered for the war in 2003. They sent me. And really, in essence, after 10 years of being in uniforms, I had an epiphany. I just never really liked taking orders from people. So I decided to walk away and never work for the man again. And I've created my own leadership and strategy company. I've been doing basically leadership and strategy consulting. And what that means is I've converted a lot of my knowledge of the military in terms of leadership, in terms of management, in terms of strategy and strategic thinking. I converted all those lessons learned into business speak. And I've been doing this since 2005. I graduated in 1999, as you said. I matriculated, oh my God, 1995. Good Lord. Look, all the gray hair, it makes sense. I can't believe it seems like it was yesterday, all those fun times. But in 1995, I matriculated. In 1997, I was obviously, I was going to get a commission. I joined, I think it was called the MPS. In ROTC, meaning I was from Florida, so I got in-state tuition and I went to National Guard training. So in a sense, it was a great step for me. So when I got commissioned in 1999, I already had 2 years of duty under my belt, so my paycheck was bigger. It was great. So yeah, 99 I commissioned into the infantry. 2005 I got out. Like I said, I volunteered for the war. They sent me as infantry officer where I worked military intelligence. That was interesting on the job training. And then I knew I was going to get out. So I changed my branch to armor to be a tanker. I wanted a different experience. And then my final duty station was in Korea in 2005. And I was an assistant war planner. So if a war happened, I would probably have been killed in the first 30 minutes, worked inside a mountain, had it was a great experience in that it was just such a catalyst to get out and do my own thing. And where I am now is because when I got out, I had 45 grand saved up. I had saved up my money and I was like, I got to do something on my own. I don't want to work for a company. And one thing that I had did in the, in one thing I did in the army was I had different roommates and we would play real-time strategy games. And people out there listening, that's not your shoot 'em up Call of Duty. That's like a Risk on steroids where people, you build nations, you build economies. And ultimately, as I'd play this, I'd realize with my best friend at the time, a West Pointer, who was a philosophy major, we would finish a battle or a war and we go outside and talk about it. And I would see this battle reminded me of Stalingrad. And he would ask questions. Why did you go A versus B? Why did you go left versus right? And I realized as I got out of the army that there were some real intellectual lessons of self-awareness, of behaviors in gaming. So I decided to, I had a very, very good opportunity to bring this into the business world, and I did. And my first big client was a small startup called LifeLock. You might have heard of them, NortonLifeLock. So I was with them when they were 30 people. 30 people. We put their whole entire C-suite, their CEO, basically all their generals, and we did the wargaming. And that wargaming experience allowed them to learn leadership and strategy on the go and allow them to apply that same kind of template for their business. So in essence, I'm telling you this because I'm about innovation. I'm about experience, not necessarily academic learning, but learning through experience, and I'm about doing new things. So I didn't know that about myself at VMI at the time. I was always a hard charger, but this has been the right course for me. This is always who I've been. And that's what I do now. So now I do leadership and strategy development for companies. I help people become better leaders and managers. I helped one high potential manager increase her effectiveness of 20% over 20% in a matter of 10 to 12 weeks. So that's what I do. Help them increase their value, help them increase their self-esteem, and help them get bigger paychecks in the end. That's what success looks like.
So that's a great story, because in there's just so many principles of what we teach through the leadership course at VMI, and what we call the VMI leader journey of the cadet growth over that 4-year period, leading self, influencing, starting to take command, and then actually taking command of the core. It sounds like you got in, you used your talents for what you knew how to use at the time, learned a lot about yourself, and then made some really life-changing, life-altering decisions to, as you put it, not work for the man anymore. What kind of decision-making process, because that's another thing that the cadets go through a lot, is how to intelligently and effectively make good decisions. What was that decision-making process like for you to decide to work on your own and then influence others to actually want to become a client?
Wow. Great question. So let me give, here's a secret that most adults don't know in business. There is no secret plan. There is no secret strategy. There is no secret decision-making process. It takes, I'm an advocate of experience. You have to hit your head against the wall several times in several different directions to know the right way. You know, being an entrepreneur, what I do now, failure is always there. I have created companies and they have failed. You have to be able to pick up, carry yourself and pick up. So to backtrack, how did I know a VMI? I didn't know it. My whole life, I always wanted to be a general fighting a big battle like Patton. Patton was my hero. And in fact, even to this day, my favorite movie in the world is Patton. So I didn't know that about myself. I was just a hard charger. I wanted to fight. That's why I volunteered for the war. I just want to go out there and kill bad guys. Over time, though, I realized, look, after 6 years in the Army, 1 year, that was probably fun. And that was my first year, because guess what? There was a new thing happening in the Army called the Medium Brigade. You might have seen them called Strikers. Well, I was in not just the unit. I was in the company that was the experimental company. So I told you before, I like innovation, I like growth. Well, I had an opportunity to be a part of something brand new. I helped create doctrine to create something just... Even my commanders didn't know these guys were all infantry, and now we bring tanks into this. They didn't know how to do it. I loved it. I was a big World War II buff. So I love that experience. So that's something I always took away. That experience, what was it about the experience I loved? The independence, the ability to make my own decisions, to be able to contribute to big picture. So when I had that, I realized this is what success looks like. Then the other 5 years, had to fall into the system. I wasn't so happy. So I realized over time, in terms of decision making, well, I obviously need to go somewhere where I can have that kind of independence and freedom. And after, you know, again, 6 years of active duty Army, I was like, I just don't want to do this again. I'd rather be poor and be happy than be rich and then follow someone else's structures. And another thing I learned is I am very headstrong. I mentioned earlier, I'm a huge fan of Ayn Rand. I'm about rational selfishness, meaning you have to do things which benefit you. You don't hurt others, but you do things which benefit you and your family and your values. So I'm all about doing things I want to do. So when you have those kind of those kind of values, and you have that kind of approach, that helps my decision-making. So when I started this, I have to tell you, for all of you guys out there listening, when you start in business consulting, first of all, you probably know hardly, you know, a fraction of what's out there. It is a learning game. It is an absolutely learning game. I learn something new every single day. So saying that, some people would say, you know, I'm just not fully equipped to do this. I can't go out there unprepared. Guess what? I was totally unprepared. But you know what? I held myself confident. I pretended like I know what the hell I was doing. And I learned and I learned and I learned. And that's what it really takes. If you see a problem out there, you don't know it. You don't throw up your hands and give up. You say, I'm going to tackle this. I may not know this, but I will. I'll make sure it happens. So there's a certain drive, I think. There's a certain drive to make it happen.
Well, that's very good. So that confidence, that self-determination of you were just going to do this no matter what, you were just going to make, and not being afraid of the failure. Talk a little bit about that in terms of, you know, a lot of people call that the growth mindset, that you don't look at it as a failure. You might even flip that dialogue to say, I think it was Edison that said, I didn't fail to make the light bulb 10,000 times. I found 10,000 ways that didn't work. And so you may not have had a clear strategy at the time for turning those failures into something successful, but it was that, would you say that you had an end game in mind, that you had a goal that you were, other than being, you know, this rational selfishness and wanting to be independent, or were those things just so prominent that it was just the path made itself?
Fantastic question, because I'm going to give you two answers quickly. I think it was, is it Jim Collins, is it Good to Great? Did I say it right? The author of Good to Great put out an article, I think, a year or two ago, and he went to West Point for some reason. He got a VMI, went to West Point for some reason to do a study, and he found that the one trait, I think it's the one decisive trait that makes leaders very effective, especially in corporate America, is the willingness to fail. And that is a fantastic, it's hard to get. I think for me, it was from, I was a four-year wrestler. Wrestling was, again, very individualistic sport, but it was all about you. If you won, it's all on you. If you failed, because it was about you, but you always continue driving. And I think at VMI, that's one thing, you have a very safe place to fail, and it's okay to fail. So that's one thing. So that's, I agree, have that mindset that you're willing to fail is incredibly important. The other thing that you asked about, you know, my path, you know, in the world of strategy, and look, the people get PhDs in strategy. Let me break it down to you in this simple way. There's one question I'm going to ask you. Can you anticipate the future? Can you anticipate the future? If you say, yes, I can anticipate the future, then what happens is your mindset falls into what they call a deliberate strategy. If you get an MBA, you hear about this guy, Michael Porter. He's the patriarch of strategy. He falls into this thing called the deliberate strategy. And what that means is, I want to go from A to D. I see a linear path, A, B, C, D, E. You know, you keep going down that linear path. And why? Because if you can anticipate the future, you know what's going to happen. Therefore, you manage the process to get there. But guess what? Most of the time, you don't know what's going to happen. Things happen, as your army's moving forward, your soldiers start to leave, other nations get involved in the war, they throw a wrench in your plan. That falls into what they call an emergent strategy. And this goes to what you're saying. Did I know specifically the path? Absolutely not. But I knew the highway. I knew the broad highway that allowed me to go from different lanes. And this is really what, believe it or not, the U.S. Army tries to teach us in what they call mission command, called Auftragstaktik. That's situational decision-making. And why that's important is, if you create a highway, a general path, you know where you generally want to go. But what happens is, as you move along, opportunities exist or pop up. Obstacles pop up, and they may change your course, but they will not deviate from your general direction. So if you have the confidence to make those changes, the self-esteem, the self-knowledge, the self-awareness, knowing where your strengths are, you can navigate that fog of war, that friction, and still hit your endpoint. But it's really important, though, to know what that endpoint is, because if you're on the wrong highway, it may look like, what's the old saying? Not all action is progress. Just because you're moving doesn't mean you're going in the right way.
Right. So that's a good point.
Yeah. So I think when you're self-aware, I think I was generally self-aware growing up. I knew I just didn't work for the man. So what does that mean? It limits my options. That highway becomes close, gets more illuminated for me. I know where I'm going. And as I move further, I've worked with big clients, 80,000 employees. I've worked with small clients up to 4. I like small growth companies. Why? Because they share my behaviors. They share the things I like, that I'm really good at. So,
well, they also are probably more agile. You know, they don't have a whole lot of, you know, infrastructure in place that they've got to move and navigate or manage. I also think that your idea of that emergent path is really more the reality. And the reason I wanted to talk a little bit about that is because, again, our primary audience being our cadets or those who are just going to recently graduate or may have just recently graduated, You know, a lot of us, I remember, you know, you have a plan or you think you have a plan of a destination you want to go to, and life happens. And so now what? So being able to be agile, to have kind of an end game in mind, or to know which opportunities to leverage and which ones to pass by, all that decision-making process, it becomes highly important. And you may not be, you may have quote unquote failed, but it's not really a failure in the end. You're moving toward a specific destination, whether your goal is to create for yourself a viable career that maybe even changes a couple years down the road. But if you've got kind of a general direction, eventually I want to get my MBA, or I want to write a book, or there are all kinds of goals that we can have. As long as you are making progress toward those goals, that's the other thing I like that you said. It's not about action and doing things. It's really about the kind of action and steps and decisions you make toward getting to that goal.
You have to have, you know, even before decision-making, you have to have a standard for how you evaluate it. You have to have, not just values, everyone has goals, but what is the end goal? And I would tell you, what is the great Napoleon Hill book? I'm totally blanking out this morning on the books. I'm surrounded by books over here, where he talks about you have to have a life goal. You have to know what exactly you want to do in life. And the one thing I would tell you, and so I'll give some free advice here, or some feedback. One, because I've helped other coaches, I've helped executives, managers, directors figure out what they want to do in life. And the one thing is, I can't tell you what you want to do in life, but I would say this: there's one rule I have, and I'm sure your audience is probably gonna, this is gonna make their hair stamp on the back of the neck. You cannot say, I want to help others. You cannot say that. I want to know what you want to do with your life. What do you want to do? If what you do helps others as a product, great. But what do you want to do? Do you want to become known for, you know, creating a new biomedical device? Do you want to change a certain industry? What do you want to do? Or do you just want to have a nice big family, a legacy? Whatever it is, you have to define that, because once you define it, your decision making becomes much more clearer. It becomes much more directed. Without that final goal, you're focusing on short range goals. They look and feel good at the moment. You know, it's kind of like the difference between, it reminds me of the ancient Greeks. There's a difference between happiness and pleasure. Pleasure is of the moment. Happiness is long-term. And that's really important. Once you have that long-term goal, what you want to do, do you want to become a general in the Marine Corps or in the Air Force? That is a long-term goal, and your decision-making will affect that. You want to become the best surgeon, whatever, but you got to do that. That's the first thing. Find out your ultimate value or values. Once you do that, your decision-making will be clearer. For me, I have found a gap in leadership development. My goal is to connect leadership and strategy together. Today, they're seen as two different things. They're not. They're absolutely interrelated, but there's no voices about it. That's my goal, is to become the go-to person, the thought leader on that subject. So everything I do is based around that.
Well, we're going to talk about values more in depth during our upcoming leadership conference in February. In fact, one of the exercises the audience is going to do is going to do to go through a list of words and come up with their top five and then maybe their top single most. And I like that you talked a little bit about using those values as part of your decision-making process.
Yeah, they really are your anchor. They are the standard of evaluation. It's having a foundation to your house. You can't build your house without a foundation. That's what that ultimate value is. And again, long-term.
I also like that you say, instead of saying something fairly vague, like I want to help people, there may be some purpose that you have that you're going to fill, quote unquote, selfishly, but your approach is that you're helping people. Like if you're going to create a medical device, or if you're going to lead a company, you're going to maybe, because your attitude or your behavior is that you want to help people as that CEO, maybe you've got really aggressive training programs so that people from the bottom are promotable in the company, and that's your priority. So you can still help people, but it's in how you're going to help people, where you're planted, perhaps.
Yeah, it's a byproduct. It's a secondary effect, and that's great. But look, if you want to help people, if you want to be a fighter for freedom, if you're an advocate of freedom, be a fighter for freedom, it's the way to do that is become good at what you do. Right. So people, it's, you know, that's the first thing. You become good at what you do. And this is one of the challenges I ask, I see with people is I ask them, what are you motivated? Well, I want to help the world. That's a cause. I get it. But if you don't help the world, what do you bring to it?
Right. Right. Yeah. What's your contribution?
Yeah.
Well, that's a good segue too, to talk about what is your definition of leadership? Talk about that. And then I'd like to follow that with getting into more of this idea of the behaviors and the motivations.
So we've already talked about, you could tell when I say bias, I am biased towards action. I hold as a premise that change will always occur. Chaos is a normal part of life. So keeping that in mind, this is really important because I'm giving you the context of my definition. All definitions have certain contexts. So my definition of leadership has four parts to it, and I'll space them out so you can hear them. Leadership is the art and science of influencing others to actualize a vision in the most constructive manner, practical. Now, there's a reason why I have this definition. First of all, it's an art and science. What do I mean? It's a science because there's a huge body. It's over 2,000 years of knowledge, of data, information on leadership itself. So that there's a body of knowledge out there, but why it's an art is it's a stylized application. You and I apply leadership differently. Why? And I know we'll get into this, but behaviors. For instance, in the audience, imagine this. I ask everyone to read the same book on how to write a book. And our assignment after doing that is to write a book. We have to write a book on the same topic, on sharks. Let's say sharks. We're all going to write that book on sharks, but guess what? It's going to be different. Why? Because we apply those principles differently. You might apply them. You might write long, beautiful sentences with, you know, adjectives and adverbs filled. I might make short declarative. I may just get right to the point, whatever. But how your behaviors of how you act, your manner of acting influence how you execute that science. That's why it's an art and science. It's being able to understand what the principles are and how you apply them. I said also the art and science of influencing others. Now notice I didn't say persuade. You have to create the kind of trust, the kind of organization that when you give a directive, you give orders, as you might say, that people will do that without having to be persuaded. And this is a tricky element. Now, for VMI, I'm sure some people in there probably know about the American Revolution. You might have heard about it. There's a great story of is it von Steuben, Baron von Steuben, the German basically mercenary came over to, he created the first Blue Book, which everyone's familiar with. And I'm sure they're thanking them in their dreams, the Blue Book. But he created, he helped Washington create the colonists to become a real army on European terms. But the funny thing about von Steuben was, when he was training American soldiers, when he was out there drilling them, remember, he knew hardly any English, but he was drilling them. He'd always complain that with European soldiers, you tell them what to do and they do it. But he'd say, not Americans. You got to tell them why. You got to tell them why. They won't do it unless you explain why, which I think to me, it's very admirable. But my point is
still true today.
Yeah. So when I say influence others, you have to create a camaraderie, a level of trust. So when you say something to do this, they don't come back asking you why, that they trust you. They know you have, they trust your decision-making and they know you have their best interests at heart. That third element I mentioned was actualize a vision. And notice I didn't say task, I didn't say mission. Why? Those are easy. Those are specified. But as the fog of war comes, as you say, as change comes, sometimes obstacles occur. Sometimes opportunities pop up and you don't have time to either report them back. You have to exploit them now or navigate them now. Do you sit there and wait or do you keep driving forward and taking the initiative? That's what it means to actualize a vision. It means going above and beyond just what your normal task is and doing those implied tasks, getting in essence to the spirit of the law versus the letter. That's really what it means. And it means training people, developing and educating leaders to have that kind of self-confidence that they can go around orders, they can go around the directives, even disobey them if the situation calls for it, if it still achieves the ultimate vision. And finally, I said the most constructive manner practical. Why? Too many, I'm sure some of you out there listening have probably heard of, you know, total quality control, 100, you know, zero defects mindset. You cannot have that. As things change, information changes, you have to do your best with the information and resources you have at your disposal. As George C. Marshall once says, once a thing is done, it's done. Move on. So you cannot beat yourself up for perfection. So that's my definition. The art and science of influencing others to actualize a vision in the most constructive manner practical.
That's really powerful because being in a communications and marketing position myself, I look at how we can communicate and connect with our audiences frequently. And there's a writer named Denise Lee Yon, and she wrote a book called Brand Fusion. So when you talked about vision, the right company vision or the right personal vision allows you to make decisions that line up with that vision. And so you can go outside of customer service rules and regulations, not to break them or not to be a rebel in the company, but to say, no, listen, this is the task, this is our vision, and I can make a decision. I'm empowered down at the tactical level to make decisions based on that vision because I understand it thoroughly. So that's pretty powerful stuff.
Yeah, let me just add one. That's a great story. That's a fantastic story. And let me add a military story as I think I even learned this at VMI. Going back to Alf Trox, talking about mission command, situational decision-making. The story is, I think it was a British major or major general. Anyway, this general lost a battle and he went back to the king to talk to the king. And the king's like, why did you lose? And the general said, well, look, you gave me orders. I follow those orders. And the king said, we promoted you to general because we expect you to break those orders if necessary.
So, right, yeah, thinking on your feet.
Yes. Yeah. But the challenge becomes the people around you, the behaviors, the motivators, the education. Do the people around you, are they comfortable with that? Because some people are not comfortable with you going outside the processes. So that's why that self-awareness piece comes to be so important.
Yeah. So let me back up just a second. You were talking about values. And would you say, is it correct to understand that one's values underlie one's behaviors? Or how are those connected?
They're connected. They're two different things. A value is something that you pursue. A behavior describes the manner of how you pursue it. That's it. Psychology tells you why you pursued it. Three different things.
Okay. Very good. So talk a minute about behaviors.
Oh man. So I would tell you for all
your whole life body of work and boil it down to a couple of minutes.
Right? Oh, I love behaviors. And I would tell you, I never learned about behaviors until I got out of the Army. And I would tell you, no one in the Army that I knew anything about behaviors. I've learned now, I think the Air Force uses some behavioral tools. I know VMI use some behavioral tools. So I have to be careful here. My book right now I'm writing is on behaviors and how behaviors are an untapped resource. In fact, that was my first article for Forbes about how behaviors are an untapped resource. So when I say behaviors, in essence, are your emotional responses to your environment. And it describes how you act. You could probably tell, just listening to me, I'm fast. I'm a fast, fluent communicator. I'm a hard charger just from my history. Some people are fast. Some people are more methodical. Some people like details. Some people do not. Some people like to take charge. Some people do not want to take charge. Those are behaviors and they describe how people act. And why they're so important is anytime you go out to execute a strategy or a plan, you're not just accomplishing a goal, but how are you accomplishing it? What kind of speed, what kind of risk tolerance do you have? How many layers of communication are filtered? All those affect behaviors. And you know, in a sense, imagine if I was a race car driver every day and I'd start driving on the road on the normal highway. Do you see how my behaviors might, how I might respond to those environmental factors? So behaviors really do this. They help. In fact, let me back up. Here's a great example I give with all my coachees. Take your dominant hand and put a pin in your dominant hand. Okay. Now, everyone, if you're listening, do this. Put your pin in your dominant hand. Now, take that pin and put it in your opposite hand. And I want you to write out, this is the best podcast I've ever heard. This is the best podcast I've ever heard. So if you write that, notice how utterly awkward it is. That's what happens when you go against your behaviors. People from the ages of, it could be from 6 to 10 years old, for some reason, whether it's nature or nurture, they actually develop certain ways of acting and they carry that. Now get this, this is what you call your natural self. That will rarely, if ever, change, ever, unless a catastrophic event like the death of a child or a loved one. That will always be you, always. But the challenge is, what most tools don't tell you is, people role play. So when you do like tools like Myers-Briggs, as we mentioned previous to this, non-scientific tools, the challenge is when you do a behavioral tool, you're answering the questions to how you think others see you. It's confirmation bias. So when you do behaviors, you always want to see who this person is and who the person is role playing. It's like going for a job. You want a job or for a company, you do your best to influence their perception of you. People do that every day. And why behaviors are so important is, if you can understand who someone is and what they're really good at. And by the way, not just where they're good at, but where they're good at. Some people are great at starting initiatives, like me. I am the king of starting tasks. I am last place of finishing them. Some people are great at finishing them. And some people are really good at grabbing onto a task to make sure everyone gets involved, that it's done. If you know what someone's natural strengths are, like Patton, the general, was great at the pursuit, not the attack, not the defense, but the pursuit. If you know what people are good at and you place them in those environments where they're good, they will excel. But if you put them in environments which go counter to the behaviors, it is stressful, they burn out, and they'll leave. Well, they'll leave in the corporate world. And the military's got to suck it up. And it's not fun, I know. So that's the work I do for behaviors. Behaviors, again, are the manner of how we act.
And how does that relate to a person's communication style? I'm hearing a difference and a bit of a distinction. But, you know, for example, myself, if I'm in a group, when I was in a group, people naturally allowed me to be the spokesperson or to lead. I like to communicate, and communication is very important to me. So talk a second or two, if you can, very quickly about communication styles and how that might relate to behaviors.
Sure. So in essence, behavior, there's really just two styles. There's sell and tell. And the example is this. There are some people who are persuasive sellers, and there's some people who are just direct tellers. I'm a direct teller. So Catherine, the difference would be like this. Let's imagine you and I were in a cafe. We work together, and I say, hey, Catherine, we're about to have a meeting. Go grab us a cup of coffee and sit down. That's telling. But I say, Catherine, we're about to have a meeting. Would you be so kind to grab two coffees for us? I'd really appreciate it. That's selling. So those are really the two archetypes in behaviors. Now, that's two different ways. But how people do it, some people are highly extroverted like me. I can just be I am loud. I can be obnoxious. If there's a party, I could be on the table dancing. I'm highly extroverted. But there are some people, by the way, who are not that way. They're much more private, and they are not comfortable at all. In fact, they have to get to know you privately. So that even affects how they communicate. They don't want to speak up unless they absolutely have to. And even if they have to, they usually don't. Mm-hmm. There are other behaviors, not really as communication style, but I'm a high dominant and what they call low pace. I have no patience. I only like big pictures. If you gave me if you hired me and you gave me an SOP and had 200 pages, I would look at this and I'm like, oh my God, I can't read this. I'll just focus on the essentials. What really important. And notice I think what the essentials are. Right. There are other people though who will say, oh my gosh, thank you so much. How could I do my job without it? They will absorb it and they will follow procedure after procedure. All those behaviors, they affect communication, they affect leadership. Mm-hmm. Some people are authoritative. They naturally have to take over. Mm-hmm. Some people are about, they're called caretakers. They get everyone involved, very participatory. Catherine, are you okay? You ready to do this? Versus Catherine, we're going to do this. Go do it. Very different. So that's why behaviors affect leadership styles, communication styles. And there's one more thing you've probably never heard of, a backup style. You'll like this. When people under stress have certain backup styles. Oh. So when all else fails, my backup style, and I'm sure there are many people at VMI had this, called dictatorial steamroller. Get the hell out of my way. I'll do it myself. Yeah. And what that means is I'll take the burden on my shoulders. Some people are avoid conflict. Some people will have a verbal outburst. Some people will fight to be right. They will bury you in data if they're overwhelmed. So that's why behaviors are incredibly important. It tells you who you are, and most importantly as well, it tells you how you respond to other people of that behavioral type. If someone yelled at me the way I usually yell, I'd be pissed. And you see it in my face. I can't hold it. But as you get older, you got to realize that's just who he is. That's just him being him. Do not take it personally.
Yeah, it's interesting to talk about that because I would say that you talk about when people have the backup behavior, it's interesting that you talk about having a backup behavior when there's pressure. So I like to talk about when the car is going down, if you add speed or pressure, wherever the loose points are, that's where the wheels fall off. But it almost seems too that in order for you to really fully understand someone's behaviors, there has to be pressure. There's got to be a crisis, a scenario for you to really see what their true nature and colors are.
Well,
And there could be situations where you're just in an environment and you do have natural behaviors that you may be in a normal atmosphere or environment. You're the kind of person that takes the notes, that does the public speaking, or if the pressure's on, you fall apart and cry.
So you know what's funny? So let me give you my perspective on this, because this is one of the things I've done with my company, Black Market Leadership, is we use Netflix and Hulu and Prime. We watch series of movies. Instead of reading business books, we actually watch a series and you pick the nuance of behaviors of people. So I think in a military setting, especially a military school, when people talk about behaviors, they're imagining battle. You know, what do people do under stress? So if you watch a movie, you know, someone's under stress, that's really who they are. That's not who they are. That's them under stress. Life is not about emergencies. It's not about constant catastrophes. Definitely. That's why when you watch a series, like a 10-part series, you see people who they are like you and I right now. It's just under really stress. You see those backup styles. So to answer your question, I think it's very hard. That's why you have to use a tool. You have to use a scientific tool. I've seen people on LinkedIn who want to watch these political figures, watch these actors tell you, this is who this person is behaviorally. You never, never do that without the tool. Because oftentimes when you see people, they're under stress and it's not fair to them. I might come off as a little dictator, but that's not necessarily me all the time. That's just me under stress. So that's why you have to use a tool to do that, because you can unfairly categorize people.
Oh, that's a very good point. And you can see that. I'm again thinking back to our cadets going through the rat line, which is extremely stressful.
Yeah, it's an anomaly. I mean, that's not real life. When you leave VMI, you can make your own rules, do your own thing. So, you know, you have people under enormous stress with no privacy. You know, they're like they're in a volunteer prison.
Yes. And you signed up for this.
I did. I did. It was worth it. It was totally worth it.
So that's a good segue to talk about the next thing to get at, again, to relate back to our audience is, how did VMI serve? You touched a little bit on it by saying it was a good place for you to fail, a safe place to fail. Talk about that a little bit, what VMI did for you and then how you've used it going forward.
I tell you, there are two things which I think were critical in my development from VMI. And really, one is general to military schools. I think most military schools probably have this, and that is the experience part. I went in there extraordinarily immature, very aggressive. And after 4 years of being an absolute jerk and cadre, I realized, like, man, I just lost a lot of cool points. Why am I doing this? So I went, when I went to the Army, I realized I didn't have to show off. I didn't have to project myself as a leader. I've been through that. And that's probably one of the reasons why I was, I had very good relations with my NCOs and my enlisted. I was like, hey man, I get it. It sucks. You got to suck it up. I just came 4 years of this thing. So of this experience. So having the experience, not just the education, but what VMI says, it really is an experience. They're not kidding. You're able to do things right now that are going to fast track you faster than your peers. So that right there is general to most military schools. But I think the one thing that VMI has, which is an incredible, incredible asset, is I'm trying to figure out the right word to say this. The multidisciplinary approach VMI has, meaning if you go to West Point, you're surrounded by Army. You go to Air Force, surrounded by Air Force. If you go to VMI, you're surrounded by all four branches.
Yeah.
And man, I cannot tell you out there how important that is, because I'm sure people listening to cadets listening to this, I had Marine roommate. I was Army. I had Marine, Air Force, Navy. I had them all, and I respected their point of view. So when I went to the Army, and I told you earlier how I went to the medium brigade, we brought in tankers. And my captain, who was a West Pointer, he was just, you know, all alpha male, infantry is the way, blah, blah, blah. And he just didn't have respect for tankers. I'm like, why? These guys could blast the hell out of the enemy. We just go clean them up. It's easy. And it was almost like a challenge to his manhood. But my point is, at VMI, you have such a great experience of seeing and respecting other functions, not just functions, but even services. Yeah. That when you go into corporate America, if you're in marketing, you should have a respect for sales, for HR, for corporate communications, for all of it. And when you have that, appreciation, a real appreciation, you are becoming what is extraordinarily needed today, a generalist. You're being able to see across the lines. That is rare today, I think. And I think VMI is an excellent, excellent point to have that real appreciation. You know, the Army and Marines may look the same. We have totally two different missions and we approach things differently behaviorally, but I understand who they are and I respect who they are. And same thing with the Air Force. So that helps me, especially when I was doing consulting work with some of these companies. I have no problems bringing in different people, different business units. Well, Kevin, we can't bring them. That's marketing. Well, why the hell not? You work for the same company. How about we speak the same language? So it is it really is. You are in a huge laboratory and this is your chance to do it now. So make sure that you're conscious that when you're doing it, this is going to help you in the end.
Well, this brings me to a nice point to segue now into talking just a minute. And then I'd like to conclude about the annual leadership theme at the center, which has been on teamwork. And we're going to talk about in our conference, February 15th and 16th, strong leaders and strong teams. So being that generalist, being able to appreciate the other business units, the other business functions, the ability to be able to work interagency wise or between the other services. It sounds like VMI does a pretty good job of exposing you to that and hopefully developing that mindset appreciation. Talk a minute about teamwork and how you foster that through this role-playing stuff that you do. How does that bring, not only does it reveal the individual character, but now you've got, sounds like a map and a strategy of who your team is and how to best position them. So let's talk a little bit about teamwork.
Boy, what a great topic. And so, as you know, I teach American military history here at Scottsdale Community. I would recommend anyone read Victor Davis Hanson's The Second World Wars. It's a huge book, or watch them on YouTube. It might be easier. But why I'm telling you this is teamwork. What does that mean? It means individuals coming together for a common purpose. Now let's really aggravate this situation. Let's throw in different behaviors. Let's throw in the hard charger who wants to attack, move forward. And let's make his team, his or her teammate, someone who is about details, planning, and doing it right the first time, slowing down. Now, Catherine, let's add in motivators. Let's add in the things which motivate them. This hard charger over here wants recognition, promotion, money. He wants to get it all. Great. The other person over here wants a workplace filled with harmony, satisfaction. He wants to be around others. That's like water and oil. And what happens is, as a good team, you have to realize who you are naturally, why I do the things I do, and appreciate them. Realize that there is a space and place for them. The same thing is, realize they're motivators. Some people may not want to take the risk that you're taking, and vice versa. There's nothing wrong with that. And the other thing that you and I've talked about are values. What do people really value? Do they want to be the next, General Patton, the next Caesar, or do they want to be the good house husband, the good housewife, the person of the family, of the community? Whatever that is, you people as a team have to come together, figure out who you are, figure out where your strengths are, figure out where those points of conflict may come. And then once you take all that information together, then you look at the environment. What is the mission that we are required to do? What are the requirements? Is speed a requirement? Is security a requirement? Is slow, methodical pace? Is quality, or is it land grab? Once you take the dynamics of that team and then compare and contrast them to the environment, you have a formula for good teamwork. But I think there's one element that is critical for anybody. Intellectual honesty. Have you heard of that term before? Being intellectually honest? That means that means accepting ideas which you may not like, which may cause you to be uncomfortable, but accepting them. Kevin, I love your passion. I love your speed, but you come off as a damn jerk. I could be like,
being candid.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I could be like, I could take offense to that. Like, what are you talking about? That's crazy. Or I could step back and say, you know what? How do I come off? Do I really come off that way? And you know so what? You're right.
I call that a sober self-assessment.
Exactly.
You're basically willing to hear the negative and just accept it for what it is, and then change what you can if you need to, right?
That's exactly right. And that's one element. Another element is, I have spent 20 years in project management. I have never done the project this way, but you know what? Your way is better than mine. I'm going to abandon that education and go with your way because it is better. So that's intellectual honesty. That, ladies and gentlemen, is extraordinarily hard to have. I tell you right now, it's very powerful, and people expect it of you. From VMI, people expect it of you. So it's only going to benefit you in the end if you could correspond to reality. Do what reality dictates. Know what you're good at, know what you're not good at. Be truthful about it and work to better yourself. You do that, all those elements, I think you're going to have a really, really good team. And going back to the World War II thing, read about the Americans and the British. We're both fighting the Germans, the common enemy, the Germans, Japanese. But guess what? They had two different objectives in mind. The British want to reestablish their colonies. Americans, hell no, we're not doing that. So just because you're a team does not mean you will have the same values. It doesn't mean you have to. It just means you have to come together for that same cause and then articulate what these conflicts may be and get over them.
Excellent. That's very good. Well, I think we've got a fantastic amount of content here for our listeners. I'm really pleased with how the conversation has gone. I'd like to give you a spotlight for just a minute to talk a little bit about what it is exactly you do, promote your website, your podcast, and then talk a little bit about what it is you accomplish with your podcast. Because if the listeners have liked what our conversation has been about, I think they could probably get a whole lot more of it from following you.
Well, thank you. So the podcast is Black Market Leadership. I've going back to what we talked about earlier, I have found this is my niche. I am about disruption. I'm about doing things non-conventional. So Black Market Leadership, this is a resource for disruptors and status quo breakers. It's not for every leader, but if you want to cause change, if you want to do something great, if you want to take on the big challenges, the podcast, we cover a myriad of subjects. My God, we covered Stephen King's Salem's Lot for Halloween, 3-hour dissection connecting to leadership and strategy. So that's the point of the website, of the podcast, is just to bring some unconventional ideas, things which are really not said out in leadership development today, and tell you what they are and help you better yourself. But the website, if you're at VMI, I have a new website coming out, blackmarketleadership.com. We have free members. And boy, if you're a free member, let you know, we do tailored coaching through Netflix and streaming services. So if you've seen the movie The Founder, if you've seen Moneyball, we have 2-hour analysis of each. I've give you surveys to help you up your leadership game, to help you articulate leadership behaviors and strategy. We have 25 hours on People versus OJ Simpson. Great show. So if you want to learn strategy and leadership, not from academic books, but to get real nuanced understanding, you got to watch the shows and come to the website, join up for free. And we have free resources and we have communities and the virtual happy hours. So if you want to meet other people around the world, get your network now. Get your network now. So blackmarketleadership.com.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Kevin, for being with us today, taking time off to join us and have this very meaningful discussion. I think it's going to be a really good episode for our listeners.
Well, thank you for having me. And it's a great institution and I really appreciate the opportunity. So thank you.
Thanks for giving back.